Thanks everybody for being here. Hasib, good evening.
John, how you doing?
I'm very well, very well. A little bit frantic because I think I got in about 12 minutes before we were due to sort of all come on here, and I was like, "Where's the link? What's the password? What's?" It was just a bit frantic. But anyway, we're here now. So thank you so much for for agreeing to sort of come and talk to us this evening. Dave gives me the opportunity to come and have these talks and have a little bit of a chat with amazing people. And I was doing a little bit of reading earlier on today. I won't tell the bosses, don't worry. I think that you've had an eclectic sort of career in various guises, but talk to me a little bit about where it all started for you, and we'll start about sort of with regards to sort of your para triathlete on and that kind of stuff.
Well, I suppose I always had a talent for sports from a young age, and I mean, people may be aware or may not be aware, obviously, from the title of the interview that I'm blind, and but I wasn't always blind. And when I was at school as a youngster, I enjoyed running. I realized I had a talent for running. I enjoyed playing football. And when I changed schools at the age of 12, going from a private education to a comprehensive in London, losing my sight, that sort of world started to close in on itself, and other things began to be more important and took priority. It wasn't until several years later, in fact, when I was in my 30s, my early 30s, I started to tandem ride just for pleasure on a weekend. A friend of mine introduced me to a tandem. We hired a tandem to go around Rutland Water. And then I got my first guide dog in 2005. The guide dog liked to have a little bit of a sprint when we left the house. I thought to myself, oh gosh, yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying this little jog, but he was a bit of a Usain Bolt of the dog world. He liked to run for 100 meters and then he gave up the ghost. So I talked to my tandem buddy and he said, I can't run with you. I've got a dodgy knee, but I know someone from church who would be happy to take you out for a spin, which he did. And he happened to be the chairman of the Leicester Triathlon Club at the time. And he used to take me out for a run, and he used to guide me. And he told me years later that the fact he deliberately told me there was cars and bollards and things in the way just to slow me down. But they didn't actually exist. They were like imaginary bollards to slow me down. And realized he wasn't quick enough. So he got other people from the club to take me out for runs. But he said, would you like to give triathlon a go? And I always like to try new things. I said, okay, that's fine. Let's give that a go. And that was around about 2008. I actually found myself later that year doing my first triathlon just for fun. I didn't really like the swimming very much. I must admit, because it's all open water swimming and I don't like the cold. But I kept going back to it, and he told me, he said, either you're going to love it or you're going to hate it. And he said, if you love it, it's going to be like a bug. And he wasn't kidding. And I found myself a year later, 2009, applying for the Para Triathlon Development Squad. And I started racing internationally in 2010. So that's the story, really.
All whilst you're doing this, and I going back to we'll come back to that in a second. Going back to sort of like your first running buddy in tandem, I love the fact that he's sort of he's now mentioned to you some years later that there were obstacles, but there weren't, just so that you'd slow down, and it's.
Yeah, I went first run. I went out with him. We went out for a jog, And he said to me, how's this for pacing? He was panting. And I went, well, I can go quicker if you want. He goes, no, I don't want you to go any quicker. So, of course, I can only go as quick as my guides. When it comes to the running, I can only go as quick as my guides, really.
Yeah.
So I've had to, over the, there's a great podcast, actually, by, very recently, by a guide of mine. It's on, it's a guy called Simon Ward that was interviewing Duncan J. Simmons, who I broke the world record with. And he actually guided Ian Dawson, my competitor on the paratriathlon scene. And very recently he did this podcast, and Simon, he said the thing with Haseeb was he was getting quicker and quicker. He was running out of guides. And he remembers when I did Barra 6, it must have been 2011, and I was running, I started off, my first mile was 5:20. And I was at the age of 42. So that was my first mile. I think I did 3 or 4 miles under 6 minutes. And overall, I did 35:42 for that. I don't think I've run a 6 miler as quick as that, actually. Of course, I'm 10 years older now, so I think those days are behind me. But yeah, it's been quite, I mean, even now I struggle sometimes to get people quick enough that are quicker than me. They need to be a bit quicker than me to have the lung capacity to actually guide me, because they've got to give me instructions.
The only thing that's in my mind at the moment is that, you know, over the years, you've worn out your guides.
Well, I've got a reputation for breaking them, so... I'll often say, I'm looking for another guy to go, I've not broken another one of you.
A quick Facebook shout for Haseeb, so, you know, to get a new running guide for you. Phenomenal. And that, like you say, you were doing that type, you know, under 6 minute sort of miles at the age of 42,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it was a great time. I mean, I surprised myself, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, and I think, in all honesty, it's one of those things, isn't it? You sort of look back and think to yourself, if I was talent spotted in my teens, and I started doing that in my 20s, what could I have done? And
absolutely, I'm pretty sure.
But you know, you can't change the past. You can only deal with the present.
Yeah,
I'll never know the answer to that question. But having said all that, you know, to be perfectly honest, from where I was at and what happened to me, I've had a phenomenal life and a phenomenal experience doing triathlons. So I've been really privileged. It could have been so different.
Yeah, I, you know, as I say, listening to you now, talking to you now, and from, you know, what I read earlier on. So whilst you were doing all of this, you know, kind of had your extracurricular activities with regards to, you know, running lots and maybe dipping your toe in some cold water every now and again, you had a day job. Talk to me. Let's start way back when. You know, coming to terms with, like you said, I think you placed it eloquently with sort of like the world bit sort of closing off a little bit as you started to lose your sight. I mean, I can't even imagine what that would be like. But to then sort of proceed and do go through education, talk to me a little bit about that, and then forward into sort of getting into work.
Yeah. So, of course, typically being from a South Asian background, my parents are Pakistani. My dad was a teacher, actually. Came over to the UK in the 60s and did his teacher training, and he taught biological sciences. He had very high expectations of myself, the eldest, and my brother a year younger than me. So we focused very much on education. And then it became very quickly apparent that I was short-sighted. I had to have some glasses. But none of us obviously knew the extent to which the site was going to deteriorate. And that didn't really start to become apparent until I was 10 years old. And my dad got a teaching post out in Zambia when I was 10. We went to boarding school for a couple of years. Sites started to kept them deteriorating. Absolutely no idea what was happening. Just knew that something wasn't quite right. And then we changed school. My father came back from Zambia with my mum, who was then pregnant with another one of my brothers. So it was a big age gap. And to be honest with you, so our family home was in Brixton. And I explained to my father that my eyesight wasn't very good and I was struggling. But he said, look, you know, just sit in the front, on the front row of a class, you know, tell your teachers. But it was really, really difficult. The school wasn't a very good school. And then my mum, when my brother was born in 1982, she went into psychiatric hospital. So, you know, where normally, you know, your mum would probably pick up and deal with that kind of difficulty or problem. She was having her own struggles and demons. And then another one of my brothers popped along 2 years later, and the same thing happened again when I was 14, 15 years old. I started playing truant at school because my best mate wasn't coping with school for different reasons. I sought sanctuary in his family flat. A couple of years out of school, after I got caught, went back to school. And again, not until I was 17, after I'd done my O-levels and not done okay. I mean, I took them a year earlier than what I would have done, because my father insisted on putting us both a year ahead when we went to the comprehensive school, because we'd been to private school. So in a sense, I didn't lose out too much in that sense. Still came out with a couple of O-levels. And then in the middle of my A-levels, that's when the eye condition got diagnosed. But it was a very difficult time. Obviously, throughout that period, I was wondering what was going on. I was going, why me? And after both of my... So I've got my brother, who's a year younger than me, has also got the same eye condition. So the two older brothers have, and the two younger brothers haven't. So he was diagnosed as well. And it was very tough. I mean, you can't imagine, because actually I never imagined that that would be happening to me, you know, from a relatively normal kind of, if you like, in inverted commas, childhood, whatever normal means, to a point at which, you know, you're kind of like confronted with this diagnosis where there's no cure and you're going to go blind one day, not knowing what the future is going to hold. So I just, because of the fact that my father had such high expectations of us, I knew I wasn't like thick, and I knew that I was bright. I was good at maths. I love maths. But unfortunately, back in those days, there was hardly any help for kids with disabilities. And, you know, whereas now you've got special educational needs and you've got resources. When I went to university, so I did get to university first time of asking, which was at Leicester Polytechnic back then, to study economics. I somehow got onto the course. I got a little bit of help when I was 17 years old going to school. But when I got to university, there was no disabled student grant back then. So basically, my sight carried on deteriorating. I couldn't even read my own handwriting by this stage. But I had no help at all when I went to uni. My friends helped me as much as they could. And the lecturers, the tutors tried to help, but it was hopeless. And I had to give it in, which was very, very upsetting at the time. And I went back down to London, took the rest of the year out in 1989, bummed around a bit. But, you know, wondering what I was going to do. But I knew I was going to go back to college. So I went back to college because I was a bit doggedly determined, and did two A-levels in a year, got top grades, got A and a B in that. And you can imagine, right? I was very determined. And then I went back to university first year, 1990. It was the first year of a disabled student grant. And my focus was get my degree, get a job. And there's more to it. I mean, there's a lot more to the story, but, you know, that's why I've written my book. All the details in there.
I'm not going to give you all the information here. Go and buy my book, which is absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
We're going to run out of time.
No. We've got plenty. I'll get a signal from Dave when we've we're reaching a certain point. So we're fine, absolutely fine for time.
Okay.
I think it becomes abundantly clear to me, as it probably is to everybody else, is you know, and I will use the phrase that you said there, which is you are doggedly determined. You know, the fact that you know you're running sub 6 minute miles, you know, at the age of 42, and you know nothing's really going to get in your way. You are going to be determined to achieve what you set out for yourself, and that comes across. And I'm sure it will come out a little bit more as we carry on talking. You know, two A levels 1 year, you know, following year 1990, you know, you go off to university. I really do take my hat off to you. I think that, you know, to sort of go through, you know, back, like you say, back then, things, you know, there were significantly different times. And you know, you've pointed out and highlighted, you couldn't even read your own your handwriting at, were you 17, 18 at that time?
Yeah, I was about 18 years old. It was, I couldn't read my own handwriting anymore. And it was embarrassing because I was in tutorials and I was meant to be university, you know, you're meant to lead some of the lectures and so on. I couldn't read my own handwriting. A lad in the tutorial started to take over. He says, look, I'm doing your job for you. And I was embarrassed. It was horrible. And so it wasn't a great time. Not good for my self-esteem.
No. But, you know, I think that there are certainly molds you, makes you.
Yeah.
And it certainly made you far more determined in what you wanted to achieve. Talk to me a little bit about, after you've done, you know, you've been successful in getting your degree. Talk to me a little bit more about the stepping stones towards, you know, where you are today. So from, you know, I've got my degree and we're now moving forwards.
Yeah. So so basically I applied to do social work at Leicester University because I was inspired by a couple of social workers that worked with me to teach me mobility and teach me Braille after I lost my sight. I thought that's, and they were both visually impaired. So I thought that's something I can do. So I aimed to get my master's from the School of Social Work. But sadly, I didn't do very well at the interview. I cocked it up. So they said to me, look, you know, you need to go get some work experience. And I mean, I was a little bit at a loss. My wife, who I met at university, we got married after we graduated. She was devastated, actually. She thought, gosh, you know, what's he going to do? And so I went on actually to, I started a diploma in information technology, which was an ESF-funded course. And for those of you who don't know what ESF, it was a European Social Fund at the time. Managed to wangle a little bit of a bursary, which brought a little bit of money in. But I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it at all. And at the time, a job came up. My wife, it wasn't... this is a time when... I don't think the internet existed. Or if it did, it was for, you know, a very exclusive group of people. And she used to trawl the papers and she found this job in the voluntary sector in Leicester, which was an organisation that was run for and by disabled people. And I remember the job advert when my wife read it out, said they were looking for people from Black and Asian minority ethnic communities and people with disabilities who were underrepresented in the organisation. The other thing that struck me was the organisation was run by and for disabled people. And I thought to myself, it was an advocacy empowerment job. And it was only 20 hours a week. And I thought, you know what, a job's a job. This looks really good. So I applied for it. And the rest is history, really. They liked me. I mean, it wasn't the first job with that organization. I had applied for another job, which I didn't do very well at the interview at, but they liked me and they invited me back to apply for this other role. So I did, got the job, and that was in January 94. And it turned into a full-time role. I had to apply for the other half of the role, but it turned into a full-time role. And as with anything else, John, I gave it a fair crack. I made it my own. I worked really hard. So following that, while I was working at this organisation, Fair Deal, I was interested in CPD, continued professional development, and I looked around and I saw that there was a really interesting master's in policy at Loughborough University that was going. And I said to my boss, would you support me in this? She goes, well, I'll ask the management committee. And they went, yeah. And in those days, you won't believe that the fees per year were £600.
Wow.
So they paid for it. I got a master's. I did a module on equal opportunities, which I loved on it. I did my dissertation on the Disability Discrimination Act at the time. And while I was just at the back end of finishing the master's, a job came up at Chandler Borough Council for an equality officer. And I had to, one of the main sort of duties of the job was to actually implement the Commission for Racial Equalities framework for local government, which I had absolutely no idea what that was about. And again, internet didn't exist. So I went down to the local Race Equality Council and I said, have you got some guidance on the CRE framework for local government? And I went, yeah, we've got a hard copy. We don't sell these things, but on this occasion, we're happy to sell it to you. Sold it to me. I did my homework and I went to the interview. And even if I have to say so myself, I was very pleased coming out of it. My wife said, I think you've got that job, haven't you? And I did. And that's what took me into local government. Yeah. So into the public sector, which is what I really wanted to do. Mm. So basically, I never went back to social work. I went on a completely different path. So I've had various jobs in local government, which sort of got me to head of service, head of equality and diversity at Nottingham City Council in 2007, which is kind of around the time, a year later, when I got into power triathlon. So I was traveling from Leicester to Nottingham every day and training, which was hard work. And there were sacrifices to be made. And then I decided to, in 2013, to... my wife again spotted a job in the NHS, equality job, slight pay cut, but it was bang in the middle of Leicester. And I thought, enough is enough. I need to see the family more and I need more time to train. So I took that job and I've been working in the NHS now, my head of service now, worked my way back up to head of service at Leicestershire Partnership Trust. So I've had, this is my third job in the NHS now. So that hopefully that covers off my sort of career journey.
No, absolutely. I've done a little bit of reading earlier on. I wanted everybody else to sort of, Bushra probably knows this already.
She's bored. She's falling asleep now.
She's like that. Yeah, I've heard this like 100 times.
I'll tell you what, I've heard her story. I never grow tired of her story.
What noted one for future. I know Bush was part of the Coy family, but it would be good, I think, one, you know, for everybody to sitting and listening to Bushra talk as well. So I'll have that conversation off air with Dave. Well pointed out, Hasib. We'll get that sorted. But you know, so thank you so much for covering that off. It really shows even through some of the toughest sort of scenarios that you have to go through, what you can achieve if you really, really put, if you are doggedly determined, which I think will probably be a phrase that we will sort of borrow from you, and use a lot more, because I think to be where you are today, I think the other thing as well is like you touched on this, is that you were head of service in Nottingham, and you're travelling from Leicester to Nottingham, and still managed to squeeze in sort of like all the training that you need that you were doing as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that if that's not an art of time management. It's one of the things that I say a lot, and I'm sure Dan says this a lot. It's not finding time; it's making time. It's something that I've spent a lot of time talking about, and I'm sure that you must have juggled a lot to get your diary sorted out.
Well, like I said, it's it's a tricky one for me to say this, but I mean, the sacrifice was I didn't see my family very much.
Yeah.
So, I see a lot of my wife now working from home, and I decided to give up the Ironman stuff in 2018, really, to be honest with you. But at the time, I was on the GB squad, and I kind of, it's one of those things, right? So I went from having very low self-esteem and lacking in confidence to becoming supremely confident. And I think one of the things about sport, I keep saying this to people, is that whilst people could judge me at work, look, he's a blind head of service. Look, he's blind. Wow, isn't he brave? Isn't he courageous? And all that kind of stuff, through to sort of people making kind of assumptions about what you're capable of or how well you can perform as a blind person. No one can judge you on the sports field. No one can judge you. Either you win a race or you don't win a race. And for me, what I did and what I had to do, because as a blind person, I had to learn to swim. I couldn't really swim that very well. I had a swim coach who worked with me 3 days a week, broke down my stroke, physically showed me how to swim properly. And it was still my weakest link. My secret weapon was my run. The bike, the tandem, spending $3,000, $4,000 on a tandem, going out constantly, it was like being on a dating game, trying to find guides all the time, quicker, faster, stronger. So
it was you kept breaking them.
Because I kept breaking them. That's right. It's like
word gets around. Word gets around that on a Tuesday evening when they all get together in a huddle.
Yeah.
They're like that. We can't go to see. He keeps breaking us one by one.
Do you know something? People did. People used to say, "Oh, I can't." Sorry.
See,
I can't do that. So.
Brilliant. During that sort of that era, somebody here sort of broke a Guinness World Record.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, I set it. To be fair, I set it. So there was an unofficial prior to 2016, there was an unofficial world record that was held by someone who was severely partially sighted.
Yeah.
And it was like 11 hours, 10 minutes. And so my guide who was guiding me at the time, Dunk, said to me, what happened when the full story is that basically my classification wasn't included in Rio 2016. So we lost the funding, the lottery funding went. It wasn't a lot of money, but I got a little bit, which helped. But effectively 2014, it meant after that, that there wasn't really anything to aim for. So Dunk said to me, how about you do an Ironman? So I said, well, we'll do an Ironman, but let me have a look to see what the current world record is. And so I saw this guy, Eric Mansell, I think his name was, and American. So got to break a record that American sets, right? So I contacted Guinness Book of Records and they said, yeah, you can do it, but you've got to do it blindfolded. So actually, yeah, the official record is Ironman blindfolded, because they say that anybody should be able to kind of give it a go. But to this day, no one's actually tried to do it blindfolded. I mean, the thing is, when I was racing, I had to do it with a was anyone who was like in the B1 category, which is the most severely visually impaired, i.e. blind, only light dark perception, had to wear blacked out goggles throughout the race. So it was no big deal to me. So I applied and they accepted the challenge, the Guinness Book of Records, and off we went, Duncan and I. We trained, obviously. And we went to Barcelona on the 2nd of October, 2016. It was on the same day as my daughter's 20th birthday. She was out there. And it was a tough day at the office. I've got to tell you, it was really hot. And at one point, we didn't think we were going to make it. The run was really tough. And I'm usually a very good, you know, good at the sort of the run. But I was suffering massively. But when it started to get dark, I felt a bit cooler. I started, my running legs came back. And we made 11 hours, 7 minutes. So broke the world record by 3 minutes. And on the finishing line, you know, I mean, my daughter said to me, she was crying. My daughter was crying and saying how proud she was of me.
Wow.
It was amazing. I mean, how often do we get our children telling us how proud they are of us? Yeah. It's not happened since, by the way. she's never uttered those words ever again. But
you've had, let's see, once in a lifetime. That's it. You've had it.
So I got the medal. I just wanted to finish the story off a little bit, because absolutely, when I got the medal, like you get an Ironman medal, and I got it engraved and I dedicated it to my daughter. I gave it to my daughter. And in there, I think I engraved something like, you know, that there's, you're an amazing daughter. There's nothing you can't do. So I don't know where she keeps it. I dread to ask her, actually, but
it's a secret.
I'll have to ask her, actually. She moved to a new house last year, so I'm going to ask her now that we've had this conversation.
Prompt to give you a little gentle,
give me a little nudge. Yeah, a little nudge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, I have to show you. I have to show you this as well.
Okay.
So this is the so I went back in 2018 to try and break the world record. We had to rush back.
Yeah.
So we did do 2018. I didn't break the world record, but I got presented with this Ironman. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Is that visible?
Yeah.
Just so that's a huge, a big,
it is, yeah,
cast iron number one. And usually only the elites get this kind of trophy. So that was lovely. That was really nice. I'll put it back.
Outstanding. It is incredible, Dave, even though you can't spell.
You don't know that, you know, my speech technology actually reads out what's being said.
Yeah.
And it came out as incredible.
Yeah, that's the one. That's another thing that we will take away from today. It's just incredible. Absolutely. When I was doing a little bit of reading, honestly, it's what you've achieved, A, from sort of like, you know, the work that you do and have been doing for quite a few years, and you know, the triathlon stuff, the running, the fact that you don't like swimming, but do you know what? we'll get in there anyway. I think he's just outstanding. It really, really is. But then I read, sort of like, you're in the Disability Power 100. You know, you are one of the most influential disabled people of 2019. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, that came about because actually somebody sort of dropped me a line and said, "There's sure trust of this like Power 100. Do you want to try going for that? I'll give you a hand." It was another blind guy actually. Never met him. He just contacted me via the net, and so I said, "Yeah, that'd be really nice." Got chatting, and then he said, "Will you give me the material? You tell me, you know." And I'll put it into the form. And I went, okay. And the next minute, so they have like a, they have different categories, you know, they have like, local government, civil service, industry and sports. So I went in for the sports category and wow. I mean, I didn't expect to get shortlisted. But not only that, I came number 22. I was like, wow, am I really that influential? I came above the, you know, the actor Warwick. He's been in,
in the film Willow and that's Warwick right.
Dave. Yeah, and I was like above him. I was going, I'm not more famous than him, surely. But, that wasn't what it was all about. For me, you know, having the recognition and being able to say that, yeah, I was on the Power 100, you know, I could have done it year in, year out. But for me, I think the significance of things like that, and I think all of you here who've had the, you have a sort of, you know, a journey that you go through life, but to be recognised for something is something really, really special. I mean, I promise you, I don't take any of it for granted. You know, I mean, I think you know, I know you know, and I was very gracious of you, John, to applaud my achievements. I think to myself, you know, some of it is down to luck, being in the right place at the right time. The other bits, yeah, I've put myself into the pain zone in terms of everything I've done. But that was really pleasurable to go down to the House of Lords, where I've never been, to the House of Lords, and have that announced. And one of my brothers actually accompanied me. For some reason, my wife couldn't make it on that occasion. Mm. So one of my younger brothers actually came along with me. So those experiences are something really special. So, I just enjoy that. Just have to kind of savor it and then move on. To be honest with you, I completely forgot about that until you mentioned it.
It's a good job I do some research every now and again. That's all I say.
Well done.
So it's always good to kind of have a little bit of an idea of what I might be talking about. Some people just say, I just don't bother. I do a little bit of research from time to time. and I will say is that I've had the pleasure of talking to some really, really fantastic people, courtesy of Dave. I think I could probably sit and have a chat with you over several cups of coffee. And maybe that is something that we do outside of this, to be fair. I'll get Bushra maybe to sort that out. Because she's a good one, that lady. Don't tell her. Oh, no, too late. But I really, honestly, it's been one of the most interesting chats I've had in quite some time. I do think we've got some questions coming in from others. I'm just looking now. What are your plans for the future within sport?
It's Good question. So I think at the moment I'm focusing on running. So I'm just running and trying to maintain my fitness, trying to get a bit quicker. I just actually did last week I did part of the Leicester Running League races, 5 miler, and I'm doing another one. I'm doing a half marathon actually on Sunday, and then I'm doing another one of the Leicester League races in September, just to sort of I want to get back on the scene because I've been a little bit out of it, really. Last year I did a couple of marathons, so I'd like to do another marathon, and I'd love to be able to sort of be able to get to close to 3 hours as possible. So at the moment, I haven't got anything like particularly planned in terms of anything with, because I am 52, so I think it's quite difficult actually at my age to get the speed back. But I like to think that I can do it, but I'm more prone to injuries, and it takes longer to recover.
Yeah.
So I think I have to look after myself. But yeah, no major plans, but keep running.
Excellent. All right. The question I've got is I want to ask Haseeb about the family role in his life journey.
My family have been really important, as you probably gathered. My wife's been incredibly supportive, if not sometimes exasperated sometimes with me. We often talk about it. I think she's pretty pleased I'm not doing Ironman training anymore. I think my body's very pleased as well. I love my daughter. You know, she's been very supportive and very patient. And then, of course, you know, my parents are proud. One of my brothers is in Huddersfield. We're all spread across. So I think my immediate family, with, you know, like Mary and Aisha, they're the ones that really have been around and helped me out when I needed help. And, of course, my guide dogs as well. Couldn't have done it without my guide dogs, Quinn and Walt, who walked me, in Quinn's case, ran me up to the gym. You know, and to work and so on. But, you know, obviously, really important part of my life, really, in terms of my independence and being able to do the things that I do. Thanks for that question.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. What about inspiring the next generation? So the next Haseeb, or the next Haseebs.
The next Haseebs. I think for me, it's really good. I watched the paratriathlon last weekend, Commonwealth Games, and it was the weekend before last, actually. And Dave Ellis, who I know very well, we raced together super fast. I mean, he was a new kid on the block, just basically blew everybody out of the water. Ian Dawson, who I used to compete with, just wanted to get to the Commonwealth Games, but he's the veteran. He didn't have a particularly good race, but you know, fair dues to him for getting there. I think I've pretty much done. I mean, I was one of the Ian, myself, and there was a couple of other guys, Dave included. We were the first ones on the scene.
Yeah,
and I think I would like to see more minority ethnic people.
Yeah,
it tends to be quite. You know, obviously, Alex Yee, the able-bodied, is, I believe, he has some Chinese heritage. It might not be Chinese, but I'm assuming it is, which is good. I mean, I think we need to see more minority ethnic disabled competitors.
Yeah.
There's plenty of us, but it's the opportunities, isn't it? The opportunities, the resources, and the right time. You know,
I would agree. I think that there are a lot of things that seem to be in the way, if that makes sense. I mean, How would you like to go about removing those objects out of the way and allowing the opportunity for these amazing people to be given the opportunity to sort of get into the sports that undoubtedly they could probably thrive in.
Well, the thing is, I think half the problem is that all the backroom staff, the coaches and all that tend to be monocultural anyway, and tend to be men in predominantly. So I think, not that I've got anything against that, but I mean, I think just going forward, I think, you know, when the whole infrastructure is, there's only one way of thinking about the sport and who's coming in and how you talent spot. You know, you need people of all diverse backgrounds in all areas of sport. You know, coaches, physios, nutritionists, hierarchy in the management, the leadership, and then you'll get people sort of attracted to the sport, and those people will want to go out into their own communities and bring in talent from those communities. Because I'm only one person, and to be honest with you, I did feel very welcoming. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the squad were great. Some of them were fantastic. I'm still in contact with them, but there were times where I just felt like I was the only brown face, even though I couldn't see everybody else. It kind of can feel a little bit like that, and I'm sure that wasn't what was intended. You know, it's never intended. So I think there's all of that needs to happen, and it's going to take time. So I would encourage young people to sort of get into it, even able-bodied people to get into para sports from different diverse backgrounds and help their fellow sort of disabled, differently able, minority ethnic men and women, girls and boys, to get into it. So, I'm not actually involved in sport in that way at the moment, because obviously I've got a day job to do. But if someone from BTF, British Triathlon Federation, said to me, "Hassan, can you come along and be an ambassador for the minority ethnics?" No one's ever asked me. Maybe really? I should ask them. Maybe you should ask them.
I was going to say, maybe sort of, flip the doggedly determined bit and just bullishly go and ask them.
See, I'll tell you something. There was a job that went as a head of equality diversity within British Triathlon Federation. I got really excited. So I said to Mary about a few weeks ago, "Mary, there's like a job. Can you look it up? Look up the salary." And it's basically half of what I get now. So I thought, oh, no. I don't love it that much.
Yeah. Thanks, but no thanks. what are your thoughts on the stigmas associated with disability or being differently abled?
The stigmas? It's the usual stuff, isn't it? I think Bushra asked that question, isn't it?
No way did you get that.
I don't know, it came up. Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, I think the stigmas, they have all, they've existed for a long time. And I think these things are really difficult to sort of unravel and unstick. I think that it's self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it, really? If you have low expectations of people because of the disability, they're going to think that they can't do it. I think in my case, I was able-bodied going into the disabled world. So I already had a kind of a sense that actually nothing was going to stop me because I was bright and I knew where I wanted to go. And there had to be a better life that's, going on benefits, which I knew that some people did do. And, lowly paid jobs, with Wimpy or whatever. So, and then I had my role models. And I think for me, society itself and all communities have to address that. You know, you have to sort of turn it around his head and try and be positive. It's that old saying, isn't it? Positive at disability. And I'm one that actually, I think, you know, you shouldn't ignore the disability. I wear it as a badge of honor now, you know. It's for me, it's part of me, my blindness, you know. It's inconvenient. There's nothing I could do about it, so I may as well embrace it, right? So I think if you teach young kids that, then, you know, parents and guardians, teachers, whoever's responsible, you know, you create a less stigmatized, it's not a stigma anymore, is it? It's something to be proud of. And why can't we be proud of the fact that, you know what I mean?
I agree. I'd like to hope that, you know, that there aren't too many stigmas. I think there are those that would choose it to be. And, you know, like you say, you know, there is you, and you wear it as a badge of pride and a badge of honour. For me, you know, I'd sort of go, you know, maybe when you aren't as busy in your day job, and I can only assume it's an incredibly busy job as it is, maybe we, you know, I think talks like this are great, but maybe get you to be standing in front of a room full of, you know, hundreds of people talking about, you know, what you do and why you do it, and, you know, all of this type of stuff. I you know, the more people that get to hear about you and about what you do and why you do what you do and what you've accomplished, for me, I think will go quite some way, just in my humble opinion.
I really do.
As always, when I have these discussions, you know, we're drawing to a close now this evening. Like I say, I could quite happily carry on chatting. I'm not allowed to.
Dave says
I'm not allowed to. So, like I say, you know, I will reach out to Bushra, and I would like to personally sit down and grab a cup of coffee and have more of a chat with you, because I'm just truly fascinated. And I think that there is a lot that can be accomplished by many of us all working collaboratively to help those that need a little bit of a coaxing, a little bit of assistance, and a little bit of a nudge in the right direction. So from me to you, it's been an absolute honour and a privilege. Thank you so much for talking this evening. Like I say, we'll catch up in due course.
Thank you
very much this evening.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Bushra, my friend.